And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO with Martin Willis and Michael Lauck. Please remember to visit the website, podcastufo.com. Check out the latest blogs and forums. And while you're there, don't forget to like our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauck will be joining us for the news in a second. Today's podcast is number 74 with Dr. Don Lincoln, who is a senior scientist at the Fermi Lab. His primary research interest is search for subatomic particles smaller than quarks. He has a new book out, which we will discuss, and it's titled Alien Universe, Extraterrestrial Life in Our Minds and in the Cosmos. He doesn't quite believe that UFOs are extraterrestrial visiting us. He needs this darn stuff they call physical evidence before he's convinced. Before we get into the news, I'll be live on a call-in radio show this Sunday, the 17th, 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you're not in Boston, Pittsburgh, Detroit, or Seattle, you can listen through radio.com, WOMC-FM. So that's it for me, Michael. What's going on with the news?
Well, first off, some science news. The Hubble has spotted a six-tailed comet and or asteroid. An article due to be published in the Astrophysical Journal Letters highlights an object spotted by Hubble named P2013P5 with an orbit like an asteroid, but multiple tails like a comet. One explanation for the strange object suggested by John Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory scientist Harold Weaver is that it is indeed an asteroid, but the six tails are being created as it breaks apart. This explanation, according to Southwest Research Institute planetary scientist William Botke, is quote-unquote cool, but, quote, far from proven.
That's pretty wild. You see, I'm going to post the picture in our show notes. It looks like someone said a sprinkler, almost. And speaking of meteors and asteroids and all that, but the Chelyabinsk near-Earth asteroid that actually burst in Russia, scientists are discovering that was just a fragment of what could be about a 2-kilometer asteroid. There was a collision some time ago, and this is a fragmented piece. We don't really have to worry about the 2-kilometer asteroid, but we do have to worry about other fragments that might have broken off in that. And coming from the direction of the sun, it's impossible to spot them. So that's interesting. It's probably about once every 25 years type of event will happen.
Oh, only once every 25 years. Great. I think this all just highlights the real need for looking into new ways to spot the near-Earth objects, particularly ones, like you mentioned, that are coming the direction of the sun and can't be seen with telescopes.
Right.
Lee Spiegel claims spike in UFO sightings linked to drones. In a recent Huffington Post article, Lee Spiegel opined that worldwide spike in UFO sightings may be linked to the rise in unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. He points specifically to the recent Canadian baseball game hoax and the Russian news agency aerial camera platform as specific examples.
Do you remember, we had that news first, remember that? We talked about that we thought they would spike, maybe 3 or 4 months ago?
We did talk about it a while ago, and unlike his article, you know, I don't think we ever have implied that drones look like UFOs.
Oh, he actually does. I know that there are some of them that actually do, you know, some of them that are the circular ones with multiple fans and things like that.
Well, that's a problem. Those aren't actually drones.
What are they called?
Those, when people talk about drones are coming to the United States, that the FAA is going to approve drones, what they're talking about are unmanned aerial vehicles that, and by definition, this is something that can be flown out of the line of sight of the operator. Okay, so those quadricopter things that you can run with your iPhone or buy or build, and they literally can be as small. I was looking at one the other day that I believe was 2.5 inches across. And they start there, and they can get up to be a couple yards across. I've actually seen people build them. If it's in line of sight, it's not technically a drone. It's not this new unmanned aerial vehicle. Those things are basically, I mean, they're basically remote control helicopters. They're toys. You know, the unmanned, the drones that everybody's talking about, which are not line of sight objects, those, you know, and I've looked into it quite a bit because this is a field I've been kind of thinking about going into. Those really almost always look like some kind of relatively large in comparison to a typical model plane of some sort. And a lot of them are, you know, 6-8 feet or much larger. Even one of the articles that we're linked to, which mentions the X-47B, which is a naval drone. I believe it's the Navy who runs it. I mean, that looks like a small version of the stealth fighter. You know, it really doesn't look like a UFO per se. You know, it looks like a known aircraft. Here's the thing. Right now, drones are illegal in the United States. You cannot buy when the drones that are being talked about, you cannot buy one. You cannot fly one. The FAA is going to open up the skyways to them probably sometime next year. They might push it back to 2015. But right now, you can't get one. Your local police can't get their hands on them. There's a half a dozen test areas, you know, across the country, and that's it. So they're really not, at least over the United States, with any regularity, unless you're around a military test facility. And they do have a UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle test facility in Nevada, I know, that's run by the Air Force. I think there probably are more. But, you know, other than that, they're not in the American skies right now. So, you know, I think a lot of people are overhyping this.
Yeah, probably. Well, you heard it first right here from Michael Lauk, dronologist. Is that what you would be, a dronologist? You probably want me to edit that out, but I'm not going to.
I don't know what they would call me. I mean, in a lot of ways, glorified model airplane dude.
Yeah, okay, I like that.
All right. Eric Von Däniken releases new book. Remnants of the Gods, the newest book by Eric Von Däniken, will be released November 25th in the United States, according to Amazon.com, although Kindle editions are currently available. In this update to his famous Ancient Aliens theory, Von Däniken moves through examples he maintains show alien influence in France, Turkey, Italy, and of course, Egypt.
Well, ironically, the guest in this podcast talks about him, and so you'll have to listen in for that. He points out some of the mistakes and things that were pointed out to him in the Chariots of the Gods and how he approached it. He's got to be getting on in age. Do you know how old he is now?
You know, I'm not sure, but Chariots of the Gods came out well over... in the 60s.
Was it really?
It was written in the late 60s. It might have come out in America in the 70s, but I believe it was 69 that it came out in Europe. So about almost 45 years ago now.
Wow. You know, if you really think about this whole thing about ancient aliens, I don't think you and I have ever talked about that in the past. But if you really think about it, you know, 10,000 years ago, whatever, is such a small sliver of time. It wouldn't make any difference whether we were being visited then, in my opinion. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, a visit from extraterrestrials is a visit from extraterrestrials. I have to admit, I don't understand the fascination with Von Däniken. I know he kind of popularized this theory, but, you know, honestly, it was in Star Trek. You know?
Yeah.
It's not his original theory. And he is not perhaps the greatest spokesperson for it in many ways. He has a rather checkered past, and he is not an academic in any way. And I think he is an easy target for people who do want to kind of dismantle the whole overall theory.
When you say a checkered past, I didn't realize there was a checkered past. Is this another conspiracy?
It's not a conspiracy. He actually embezzled money from a hotel. I mean, he was convicted of this in Switzerland. I believe he was involved with some kind of criminal charges in Egypt before that as well. And that's how he funded the travels for Chariots of the Gods.
Well, someone had to pay for it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes. But, I mean, that doesn't put one on the most solid and reputable ground to begin with. And then, like I said, I mean, he is not an academic in any way, shape, or form. Although he popularized the theory and kind of brought it into the mainstream, perhaps. Like I said, 40 years later, I don't know that he quite deserves the air of respect that he is granted in the UFO community. And I think he really might be more of a detriment in a lot of ways than a help.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. Hey, you know, last week we talked a little bit about Art Bell, and we got quite a bit of email about that, of varying opinions, and a lot of people didn't like all the things we said. But you know, I'm friends with Art on Facebook, as in as many people that can be. I think, what is it, 5,000 is the limit or something like that. But I'm seeing the struggles he is going through right now, and he really can't do anything with this non-compete clause that he has in his contract with SiriusXM. So who knows what he's going to do? I guess he's going to lay low. But
SiriusXM has since gone back and renewed their contract with Coast to Coast, which had lapsed several months ago. And I believe they were only on XM plans before, and now they are on both Sirius and XM plans. So I think they have decided to let Mr. Bell's ship sail.
Wow. How about that? I didn't hear any of this part. When did that come out?
It was just announced this week. So actually, you know, as far as when we're recording, it was just announced. By the time people are listening to this, it'll be a couple days.
Yeah. Hey, is that it for the news today?
That is it for the news today.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Michael. And we do have a little bit of a sound issue here. You can hear it. We're trying to figure out what's going on, and hopefully we'll get that fixed by next week. Well, thanks, Michael, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right. I will talk to you next week. Have a good week.
You too. So stay tuned for this interview with Don Lincoln coming right up. Okay, I'm with Don Lincoln. How are you, Don?
Fine, and yourself?
Great. You are a physicist at the Fermi Lab, and we were talking about your book that came out, and can you say the title of that?
Yes, the title of the book is Alien Universe, Extraterrestrial Life in Our Minds and in the Cosmos.
Well, that pretty much says it all right there, doesn't it?
Yeah, that I like the title. It does. There was, of course, you know, some discussion with the publisher as to what the proper one was. And when we settled on this, I was quite happy with it.
Yeah, that's great. Now, before we get into your book in general, there's some questions I thought it would be great to ask you that I've thought of. And I recently had an astronomer on, and I forgot to ask him this question. So this has to do with the Big Bang, basically.
The way we calculate the Big Bang is by going backwards from our expanding universe, more or less. But with the discovery that the universe is actually expanding faster and faster, a thought came to mind. Could you assume that if it's going faster and faster, then maybe it used to expand slower and slower? And if so, that would seem like it would make our estimate of age of our universe very difficult to judge. What is your thoughts about that?
Well, see, here's the really nice thing about that. We are able to look out into deep space, and in doing so, we see things that are, of course, very far away and a long time ago. So it's not that we are guessing how the universe was expanding in the past. We actually measure it. You look how far away they are. You look at the velocity that they're expanding at. And so the age of the universe is actually pretty accurately known. It's known to like a part in a thousand or so. It's quite impressive.
And I understand that it's recently increased a little bit.
Yes.
Our age calculation. 13.8 billion or something like that.
Right. It was something in the order of 13.7, and now it's 13.8. So it's like parts per thousand is where the changes are occurring now.
Would you ever consider the fact that it's a possibility that the Big Bang theory might be all wrong?
This is one of the questions that one gets often. People somehow think of science in the same way as people think of, you know, political philosophy or religion or something. In science, everything is open to question, always. It just happens that the data is strongly supportive of the Big Bang. However, if we find some data that is contrary to what the Big Bang theory predicts, then that Big Bang theory is dead. Scientists don't hang on to these theories, you know, in sort of an emotional way. I mean, we like them, they work, but sure, I would easily drop it if the data pointed in that direction.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder if we know just a little tiny fragment of what is really the truth in the universe. It's just so mysterious, really. That's my own opinion, of course. With the discovery of the Higgs boson recently, there's more or less solidifying of the Big Bang theory. Can you explain how that fits in?
Actually, the Higgs boson and the Big Bang theory are really unrelated. They have some small connections. The Big Bang is simply the theory that the universe was once much smaller and hotter and is now expanding from that primordial state. The Higgs theory tries to explain the behavior of matter at a stage in the universe. At the Large Hadron Collider, where I do my research, we can recreate the conditions of the universe about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And that allows us to understand sort of in detail not the exact instant of the creation of the universe, but shortly thereafter. And so if it turned out that the Higgs boson idea is totally wrong and we have to get rid of it, it doesn't negate anything, the sort of fundamental premise of the Big Bang, which was the universe was hotter and smaller and is expanding. So, you know, the Higgs just tells us an era in the universe an era in the universe. And so they're related, but not so intricately.
Is there an easy way to explain what the Higgs boson is?
Yes, there are a lot of them. And if you would like, I can send you a lovely URL. I made a video with the TED Ed people that is the best explanation, in my opinion. So let me kind of sketch that out right now. About 20 years ago, the British science minister had a contest and asked scientists to write down what was the nature of the Higgs boson on one page of paper. And so the winner was a physicist by the name of David Miller. And what he described the Higgs, both field and boson, is the following. Because the Higgs field is the thing that gives particles matter. And an analogy for that is, suppose you have a large cocktail party and two people enter the room. One is a famous scientist, say Peter Higgs, and one is a less famous scientist. The less famous scientist can walk across the room and get to the bar without any difficulty because he does not interact much with the field. In contrast, the Peter Higgs, when he walks across the room, people are wanting to talk to him, tell him about ask him about his theory and so forth. And so he has a much more difficult time crossing the room because he interacts far more with the crowd. In the same way, particles interact more or less with the Higgs field, gaining more or less mass. So that's how particles are given mass by the Higgs field. The Higgs boson is a clump in the field. It's like a vibration. So the analogy there is, suppose someone at the door announced a little rumor. Well, the people near the door would crowd around to find out what the rumor is, whereas people far away wouldn't even know anything is going on. However, people near the clump talking about the rumor would then drift over to find out what's going on. Whereas once people figured out what was going on, they'd go back to where they were talking to their friends. And in this way, this clump of the rumor would wander across the room. And that clump is analogous to the Higgs boson. So the Higgs field is the more fundamental thing. It's the thing that gives mass to particles. But the boson, the clump in the field, is the way that we are able to see the field and show that this idea seems to be true.
Wow. Wow. All right. Well, getting back to your book, can you give our listeners an overall synopsis of it?
Well, the book has two parts to it. I was sort of fascinated by the question of why, when you walk down in a mall or something and you just pigeonhole a random person and say, what does an alien look like? The common answer you will get is a little 4-foot-tall humanoid creature, gray, egg-shaped head, big almond-shaped eyes. And so I was actually interested in how that came to be. I mean, obviously we see it in the media, but I was trying to trace back the development of that archetypical alien. And then as I did that, you know, I started remembering cartoons when I was a kid when aliens were little green men and when that transition occurred and so forth. So I ended up digging into the history of not necessarily all alien reports, because that's a great broad body of knowledge, but the ones that made a big impact on our culture. And so for that, you hit the biggies, starting with the initial UFO reports in 1947 through Roswell, and then some of the other big people, George Adamski, Betty and Barney Hill, Von Daniken, and so forth. And these were, I just wanted to look into that and see how these reports fed the media, because most people don't get their information from reports about UFOs or extraterrestrials. They basically see things on TV and the movies. And so I was interested in the interplay between the reports and the movies and how the movies told people what they should be looking for. And a classic case of that, this is the first report of UFOs in 1947 near Mount Rainier. Were reported as being like the tail of a kite, and other descriptions like fish flipping in the sky and so forth. And finally, the person doing the report talked to a reporter and said, the things moved like a saucer skipping across the water. And so if you actually read that original report, the reporter said what the observer saw, but the headline writer said, guy sees flying saucer. And so immediately after that, people started seeing flying saucers, even though that really wasn't what the original report was. And so this kind of feedback was very interesting to me. So that's the first half of the book. The second half of the book, I felt that it would be interesting to say, or to explore, what modern science teaches us about what is possible. I mean, I used to read science fiction as a kid. I read thousands of science fiction books, and I loved them. But, I mean, there are things that are just simply impossible. And by understanding things like how chemistry, what limits chemistry places on the possible. For instance, it's essentially impossible to have a helium extraterrestrial, because helium is not something that interacts chemically. It doesn't work. So you can't have a body made of helium, for instance. And as you explore that, you find out why carbon is a preferred atom. But also silicon, which has similar chemical properties, is not as good a building block of life as carbon is, because it doesn't have exactly the same properties. So anyways, the second half of the book describes a lot about what science tells us about the possible. I mean, I don't know, and a reader who reads my book won't come out being told this is what an extraterrestrial might look like, because nobody knows. But we know a lot about what it won't be. And so that's what the second half of the book is about.
Well, I'm kind of interested to hear what it won't be. That's kind of interesting.
Well, it comes down to really chemistry and atomic physics. If you look at a periodic table, there are various columns. The right-hand column has helium, neon, argon, and so forth. Those are noble gases. Those don't interact very much. And so they don't play any significant role in chemistry because these atoms just sit there and mind their own business. On the left-hand side, you have things like hydrogen, lithium, and so forth. And these elements only can have one bond. And because they have one bond, they can only make very simple molecules. So to have something as complex as life, any kind of life, you will need I should back up. And there's a very important and crucial point here. This book is not about extraterrestrial life in general. This is not about, you know, slime molds around Deneb 4 or algae around some planet near Betelgeuse. This is about intelligent extraterrestrial life. And so that puts a significant restriction on the kinds of life we can think about. Because anything that is comparable to us, not like humans by any means, but comparable to, in the sense that it's intelligent, tool-using, and could conceivably one day vie with humanity for galactic domination, has to be made of complex chemicals. And so once you start exploring that, you find that there are only some elements that can have many bonds, carbon being the best. Silicon is often used as an example, as another element that can have four bonds. But if you explore it in more detail, you find that even though carbon can have four bonds, or let me rephrase that, carbon can have four bonds, and all four bonds have sort of equal strength. Silicon, on the other hand, can have four bonds, but not all the bonds are equal strength. So it makes it difficult to move atoms around easily. Whereas in carbon, you can move atoms around, and that allows for complex chemistry. In addition, the bond between carbon and hydrogen, carbon and oxygen, carbon and nitrogen, are all similar in strength. And so it makes it fairly easy to swap in various elements. Whereas in silicon, silicon-oxygen bond is very strong. So once a silicon is bound with oxygen, that's basically sand, silicon dioxide, it is very difficult to break it apart and bond silicon with carbon or silicon with nitrogen or silicon with any other elements. And so, you know, silicon is just not an optimum element, even though there's plenty of examples in science fiction of silicon-based life. It's hard to imagine that silicon is, you know, a good candidate for life. And let me give you one sort of compelling thought. If you look at Earth, there's far more silicon on the surface of the Earth than carbon. So there's a huge reservoir of silicon, and yet life on Earth uses carbon. I mean, that says something about the relative merits of the two elements.
Wow, I never heard that part of it. Would you consider that the most likely type of being would be binocular vision and biped?
I doubt it. Doubt it.
Okay.
I am as yet unconvinced as to the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. I think the data on that is not incredibly compelling. But when you just think of the variety of life that there is here on Earth, I mean, spiders with multiple eyes and so forth, and how many times vision has evolved independently in different life forms. If you just look at the vast variety of life here on Earth, I think the bipedal or nature is basically an accident, an evolutionary accident that works, but I don't think it's unique.
Are your opinions on extraterrestrial life that you believe, you don't believe that it's actually out there, or did I just take that wrong?
No, what I think I would be willing to say about extraterrestrial life is I think life is probably fairly common in the universe, where life, by life, I mean a very low threshold of life. I think intelligent life is probably far more difficult and quite rare. I'm quite open to the possibility. I think it's probable that there is intelligent life in the universe somewhere. The universe is big, but whether it's near us or some not, I think is, you know, it's less probable because, well, the spot near us is small and space is big. And then there's the question of whether we are being visited or something, and I think that's quite unlikely. I don't, you know, as a scientist, I remain open to new evidence, but I would characterize myself as a fairly strong believer in life, a believer in intelligent life, but think it's rare and probably not nearby.
Well, I promised you I wouldn't debate you about UFOs, so so I won't, but you said that it's very unlikely, but you think that it is possible. I mean, you look at what we are doing. We're exploring space as much as we have the know-how to do. If there is an advanced technology that figures out how to do interstellar travel through physics way beyond us, do you think it is possible that we have been visited?
Possible? Possible is a soft word, but yes, anything's possible. Yes, it's possible. But yeah. Possible and likely are different. I certainly, I'm quite cognizant of the difficulties of interstellar travel. And yes, it is possible that something that we see in science fiction like warp drive or something like that might be invented. And I actually really seriously hope it is. But I don't really understand how. Things like generation ships and things like that are, of course, possible. I suspect that someday... it may be that mankind takes upon itself to explore the galaxy, but it'll probably be in sort of a tedious way of traveling like that, either using using relativity to make the trip seem shorter, or through some kind of sleep technology or generational ships or whatever. And I hope I'm wrong. I really do hope that the Starship Enterprise starts zipping around the universe, but I remain skeptical.
Yeah. Now, how have your colleagues viewed your book?
I think my colleagues have been supportive of it, since it is not inside their particular topic of interest. I have not had a whole lot of discussions. I got far more discussion from the other books I wrote, which were more on particle physics and cosmology and things like that. The Alien book, my colleagues, patted me on the back for doing it, but... that's sort of the extent of their interest.
So what was the initiator of you starting the book?
Well, the initiator of the book was basically, I was curious about aliens when I was a kid. I was curious about science fiction as a kid. And as I grew older and understood science better, I realized that a lot of science fiction is not accurate. And so I thought it would be kind of neat to write a book that sort of blended the two, had some science fiction and had some science. And the stories that I have about sightings of or reported sightings of UFOs over the last 50 plus years draw people in. And then they can actually read about what the science of astrobiology is likely to be. And so I thought it was kind of a neat way of merging these two interests, the science fiction buff and the science buff. So it's kind of why it was designed that way. And we will see if this was successful.
Right, right. Well, getting back to UFOs, I told you I would just touch on it lightly. One of the things that comes to mind is, there are astronauts that have claimed to have seen something. There was, the governor of Arizona... along with about 10,000 witnesses, the Phoenix Lights. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. But there was many mass sightings and many credible witnesses, as far as police officers and military, that have come forth and could not really be explained as to what they were. Have you ever looked into any of that?
I cannot say that I am a scholar of what one might call as UFOlogy. And I don't hold up police officers or military as being any better or worse reporters than any other person. There's a tremendous amount of psychology out there that describes and explores how people can be mistaken in their observations. I mean, I'm a scientist, and I have more than once thought I knew something, been absolutely sure I was right, only to find out I was later wrong. Now, I don't discount these reports, but the anecdotal reports that one gets do not persuade me. That does not mean that I think these people are lying. They might actually be seeing exactly what they think they're seeing, in which case nobody would be more pleased than I. I mean, I really wouldn't be at all displeased to see, you know, a flying saucer descend on Washington and have a little guy come out and say, take us to your leader. That would be fantastic. But in order to persuade me, I would like to see better evidence. I mean, you know, and the problem is with so much of this UFOlogy is that there is a tremendous amount of hoaxes and charlatans and so forth. And people who are what I might call honest UFO researchers are aware of that, and they try to you know, get rid of those. But I just will need a lot better evidence than I have seen so far. Mm-hmm. And I admit that I am not, you know, not dug into every particular report. But, you know, we live in a world with everybody's got a cell phone. We live in a world where, you know, it just seems that it would be easier to get far better evidence than the things that I've seen. Everything I see is always, you know, kind of fuzzy and the camera jitters, and or it's just a report of something someone saw. And of course, I've seen things that I don't know what they are myself. I don't mean UFOs, just, you know, things out of the corner of my eye, and I turn and it's not there. So, you know, I just need a stronger level of evidence to persuade me.
I understand. And the other scientists I've spoke to have said very similar things. And I think it's to the point where either if the image or the video is blurry, then it's discounted. But if it's too good, then it's also discounted as being fake. Even video or photo evidence is weak unless the witness reports are real solid. And it is a very eluding phenomenon for sure. So this kind of leads me to ask you what you think about SETI.
I think it's fantastic. I wrote about it in the book. The last chapter of the book is about SETI. I think given the difficulties that with extraterrestrial travel as we understand it now, setting aside such things as warp drive and, you know, stargates and whatnot, we do know that you can, radio waves can travel many light years, hundreds of light years, thousands of light years. So it would not shock me in the slightest if there is a nearby extraterrestrial civilization at our level of sophistication or higher, that the first way we'll encounter it is through radio contact. So I'm very strongly supportive of that. I mean, I really would like to find out that we're not alone. But, you know, I think that the SETI is probably the best way to do that.
Our last guest, who's an astronomer, was saying that it's a possibility to see signs of life through chemical analysis of exoplanets. So that is also another way to explore. And it seems like we are getting closer and closer to finding that truth out.
Oh, absolutely. It's a shame that the Kepler satellite, the gyroscopes broke. I mean,
yes.
That's a complete shame. I hope that NASA puts something else up there and keeps working on that, because that is fascinating science.
I think it's taken us a leap forward for sure, and I really hope that they continue that. I think it's very, very important, mm-hmm. and I hope they get the funding for it. Can you touch on a couple of other areas in your book that are interesting?
Well, It's all interesting. Every single word of it. If it wasn't interesting, I wouldn't have written it.
I didn't mean it like that.
I know. Yeah. I like the stories. I mean, there are people who are clearly clever and fakes, but they have an impact. For instance, George Adamski. If you read the story, I don't know if your listeners are completely familiar with it, but he was a spiritual leader. He had students that would be with him, and one day he took them and some of his students and a few other people out into the wilderness, and told them to wait while he went off alone, where he encountered aliens, UFOs, and actual people, and these people were beautiful, reminiscent of his angels. And so then he came back with a message from them. I mean, this just, is a lovely use of an awful lot of religious stories that have happened over the years. And now Adamski, I'm pretty confident, was a con man. And that's perhaps harsh, but I mean, this guy was charming and genial. And later in life, he went around giving talks, accompanied by Venusian bodyguards, which are these two statuesque Amazonian women, beautiful women. They're supposed to be his bodyguards from Venus. And then he explained what the back of the moon looked like and what Venus looked like and so forth, which we now know to be completely untrue. But it's a lovely story. He's a charming man. Von Daniken's another guy who I talk a little bit about. And I mean, I was never persuaded by his writings, although when his writings came out, I was a teenager and I read them avidly. I thought they were amazing. But I have actually seen him speak. I mean, recordings of him speaking where people pointed out inaccuracies in what he wrote. And he would say things like, well, sometimes you have to change the story to make it a little bit better. I mean, and he said that. It's not like people reported it. And I read a transcript. I saw this guy say that.
Yeah.
So, I like that part of it too, because there's a lovely human element to this. People want there to be, extraterrestrials, or at least a lot of people do. It excites the imagination. And so people who tell these stories are telling them to an audience that wants them to be true. So I very much enjoyed learning about some of these characters as I did the research. There's another neat story in the book that I like, and this is in 1835. It's the Great Moon Hoax. And in the New York Sun, they had a multi-day article talking about how a researcher figured out some way to hook a microscope up to a telescope so that he could look at the moon well enough to actually see insects on the moon. And over the course of the multiple days, the story unfolded as to what was seen on each day, ending up with alien life on the moon. And that was neat. It was well known to be a hoax. Scientists knew that it was a hoax, but it took the world by storm. And the thing I found interesting about that is it did occur in 1835. And why is that interesting? Well, it's because it was only in 1830 that inexpensive newspapers were available. Prior to that, newspapers were very expensive and only printed for the wealthy. But in 1830, they had what they called the penny press. So a newspaper would cost a penny. And the way that business model worked is if you made it for a penny, you had to sell a ton of them. And so that was the era where you got little kids with hats on saying extra, extra, read all about it began. And so with the advent of this new multimedia that allows people to communicate much more freely than before, we had this first mass hoax of life on the moon. And, we live in a new world now where the internet provides an amazing amount of ability to communicate. And so we see, I'm not picking on, UFOs or aliens here, you see an awful lot of hoaxes and so forth because the filter between the writer and the reader. There's often not the editor there to weed out the, shall we say, creative stories there. But anyways, I really like the Moon Hoax of 1835. I was unaware of this when I started my book.
Yeah, that really is amazing. I didn't know the details of that. I've always wondered what the genesis of hoaxers are, and a lot of them is fame, possibly, but also along the lines of what you're talking about, most likely. Now, Arthur Clarke had a nice saying. He said, two possibilities exist. Either we're alone in the universe or we're not. Either one is terrifying. It's along those lines. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes along with your book and what you're saying here.
It's true. And if there is life out there, it's potentially terrifying because, I mean, it's hard to understand the psychology of a species that we can't even understand their biology. But we do have ample examples in our history of advanced cultures encountering less advanced cultures. And the less advanced cultures rarely do well.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And if aliens were to come to Earth, they certainly have a transport technology that we don't have. There, it is possible that they would have other technology, weapons, and so forth. So, you know, there's a degree to which you have to wonder, is it really a good idea to be telling the universe that we're here?
Yeah. We can't stop all the radio signals we sent out already, though, for one thing.
That's true.
Yeah.
But that's only a radio bubble. That's only 100 light years in every direction. And there are not many stars in that bubble that are sufficiently similar to ours that it would be likely that creatures would have a similar biology and be interested in Earth. I mean, if you had creatures that, I don't know, like to live on Titan or something, they might come here and hang out on Titan, but it's, you know, they wouldn't like living here. It'd be a bad place for them. So,
right.
I mean, you know, plus another thing is 100 years ago, the radio signals really weren't that strong. Mm-hmm. So the real effective bubble is smaller than that. But it's true. It's absolutely true that we have a radio bubble and it's expanding. And if there's something out there listening, he might say hi.
Right, right. Now, the last guest I had on, the astronomer, said that with the work that Kepler has been doing, you can calculate that in our galaxy alone, there's possibly 17 billion habitable planets and growing. That was according to what he said.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned earlier that the possibility for life and the possibility for intelligent life, there's a big difference. Can you go into that a little more?
Well, this is just a numbers game, and we only have one example to really look at. But we know that life formed on Earth shortly after the Earth cooled enough to have a solid surface and water. You know, the numbers vary depending on your threshold of belief. But life could have formed on Earth, you know, of order 3 billion years ago. And that's not long after it became even possible. On the other hand, from, you know, 3 billion or 2.5 billion years ago to 500 million years ago, you had unsophisticated life underwater, often unicellular, and some of it was not unicellular, it was multicellular, but it was not very complex. It's only 500 million years ago, so, you know, billions of years of life before we had a little bit more complex life, where oxygen started to become prevalent in the atmosphere, and oxygen provided the power to make animals possible.
Right.
And then from there, 500 million years ago to, you know, you could set the threshold in several places, but approximately 100,000 years ago, Homo sapiens evolved. You might go back a few million years ago prior to that, where the hominid line evolved. But if we didn't exist, if the hominid line got wiped out, and this came close a couple of times in our species history, there's no alternative out there. There's no, you know, we're not fighting with intelligent cats or something like that. And so it took a long time for our variety of intelligence to evolve, whereas it took life almost no time to begin. And so, granted, it's only one planet. It's hard to generalize from a single data point, but it's not completely fair to call it a single data point, because there were those 500 million years from sort of complex multicellular life to us. And, you know, it didn't evolve. Dinosaurs didn't evolve our kind of intelligence. You know, earlier creatures didn't. It took a very long time. And that suggests to me, given the millions of species that are out there, that intelligent life is rare. And it's not a airtight case. I don't suggest that it is. But I think it's a compelling case.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you mentioned basically that intelligent life, if it were underwater, it couldn't really advance. I thought that made a lot of sense.
Well, I believe that it's possible that there could be the equivalent of cavemen dolphins. But my book was focused predominantly on intelligence of the type that might explore the galaxy. And I find it very difficult to imagine a intelligent species being able to evolve very far technologically without being able to form metal. And you know, you just can't have fires underwater, so you can't smelt metal. So that's the real turning point there. It's the inability to have combustion.
Right. So where would someone find your book?
Amazon. Amazon.com. Okay.
And do you also have a website?
I do. I have my website is more generic. It's not just about this book. It's about the many different types of scientific communication that I play with. But I'm on Facebook. And so facebook.com/Dr. Don Lincoln. I chatter with people who post there. And I hope it's a neat site. I talk about all sorts of neat science that we're doing at our laboratory. And anything neat that comes up about aliens, I'll post that there as well.
So thank you very much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure.
Well, you're quite welcome. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you for listening to our show. And please remember to check out our website, podcastufo.com, for the latest blogs and forums. We will be back next week. Thanks again, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky.